Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Albion Obsessed podcast. Don't adjust your screens. We do have two new people on today who we will introduce in just a moment. But before we get into the episode, let's introduce the one regular that we do have on today is Dagan from the US of A. How are you doing, sir?
Quite well, Joe. Quite well. The weekend is a distant memory at this point. As was last weekend, also very distant memory, not harboring any ill feelings. Just, you know, onward and upward, up the Albion.
Up the Albion, Europe to look forward to, Sheffield United at home to look forward to. And he's got his Europa League mug. Look at that. Right on cue, Dagan. Thank you very much. And we welcome James to the podcast for the very first time. James, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. How are you today?
I am not too bad. I've already spoken to you today because we did something for your uni work, which was great.
Yeah,
fun.
We did. It was so much fun.
Yeah, I had to make up the fact that I broke my foot. It was hilarious. But it's all good. And we do have on Alex on the podcast today. How are you, Alex?
Very well, thanks, Joe. Thanks for having me, guys. Dagan, good. Lovely to have you, well, be with you as well. James, lovely to meet you. And very excited to be on tonight and obviously offer any insight into the club and the fixtures that we've got coming up are very exciting as well. So just pleased to be here.
Indeed. No, thank you for joining us, Alex, and saving the day. As always, what I like to do when we do have new Albion fans on, and I didn't tell you guys this, I'm going to put you on the spot. We like to ask three questions. So, Alex, I'll do your three questions first. Oh. So, what was your first ever Albion game?
Would have been, well, this is going to show my age, Joe. Back at the Goldstone. I was a junior seagull in my youth. So, that was what they used to call young fans back in the day. You know, we were members of what would be called the Junior Seagull Club. Christmas cards would still be delivered. And, you know, I used to write to the club for extra memorabilia and things like that when I was a wee boy. So but going back before then, my father was, he used to live on Old Shoreham Road as a kid, and he was at matches, you know, at the Goldstone and at the highest ever attendance, 36,000. He was there, you know, on Boxing Day in the 70s. So. You know, it goes back in the family history. For me, Man City, I think 1991, my first ever game. I would have been 9 years old at the Goldstone, possibly eight. I can't remember. But, yeah, I mean, we drew 1-1 against Man City.
We'll take it. We've beaten them since, so we'll take that as well. Actually, we've beaten them twice since. Both 1-1 penalties at the Wifteen and at the Amex as well. So, yeah, we'll take
sounds
that.
More- We're in Division One at the time. It sounds more glamorous than it is. Our main rivals back in those days were teams like Stoke City. Fulham have always been a huge rival for us in Division One, in Division Two. Sorry, it would have been Division Two. This is pre-Premier League, so you know. But Division Two, we were playing really good football. We had players like Dean Wilkins playing for us. We had a Russian international that came on loan for a season called Sergei Gotsmanov. He was absolutely incredible. He lit us alight. I mean, he was absolutely phenomenal. He was, in those days, you generally only had one international player come across from non-European outlets, and Sergei Gotsmanov. People will remember him.
I love that. Talking of players, has there been a favourite player that you've seen in the stripes? If you had to pick one?
Yeah, Bobby Zamora for me, because obviously I saw him transition through. I mean, I've got his top from the centenary era. You know, I had that as a teenager at university, number 25. So I still keep that. Actually, I need to get that the numbers and the name on the back redone. I found a company that can you know, improve your numbers if they come off the back of your shirt. So I want to get my Zamora top reconditioned. But yeah, for me, his physical ability, the way he was able to command presence on the pitch. I was devastated when we lost him to Spurs. Spurs came and bought him. And his career actually took a bit of a nosedive after that, which was a shame, which is a lot of quite often happens when players go to Spurs. as we see,
Kasuma, we're looking at you.
Yeah, he's come back this season, obviously, but then that was obviously a Conte problem that Kasuma had last season, and he's really doing well this season. And you know what? I'm so delighted for Yves Bissouma. He's a great player, and I wish him all the best.
Yeah, he was fantastic for us. Talking of shirts, you mentioned a great shirt there. Has there been a favourite Albion shirt that you've had over the years?
I mean, my collection's building now. I've got about 17 shirts at the moment. I've got some long sleeve, some short sleeve versions because I like them so much. I like Brighton and Hove Albion jobs. Do you know the sponsor that we had?
Yeah.
Just classic shirts, you know. Era were a good sponsor for us. They put together a good kit. That's generally my kit. I love the green and black kit from that era as well. I do love this season's green and black away kit. It's absolutely fantastic. But like Lewis Dunk, I do like the original green and black stripe kit, which was from that era.
Yeah, the original was absolutely stunning. James, we're going to come to you now with the same questions. Do you remember your first Albion game?
I do. I was about 7 or 8 years old at the With Dean. That's Goldstone was long gone by the time I was around. Yeah, I have no idea who we were against. I was more interested in my packet of chips, to be honest, rather than the match. But then my second game was the game against Doncaster. So I remember that one a fair bit more.
Yeah, I can imagine. What was that like being there on that day, the day we returned to a permanent home and seeing us win in that fashion?
It's quite an impressive day, to be honest. It was quite a few years ago, so I don't really remember it that much, but it was just amazing walking out, you know, seeing everything. It's like, you know, this is sort of home. It's not, it's an actual stadium. It's not crappy with Dean, you know. If it rains, you're not getting wet. It's not bad.
Yeah, that's fair. There's two members of this podcast that will cringe at you saying crappy with Dean. That is their special place, James. So you'll be on their hit list. Has there been a favourite player over the years that really stands out for you?
Got to admit, did love Craig McHale-Smith a few years back. Inigo Calderon, but then in more recent years, probably Glenn Murray. Class player. Going away, coming back. I mean, remember that goal at Selhurst against Palace a couple of years ago? Quality goal. I mean, what more can you say?
What a ball from Dunkey and what a finish from Mark Glenn. Absolutely unreal. Peak Dunkey. That was lovely. Peach of a pass. And has there been a favourite shirt that you've owned?
Probably the one I'm wearing now. If not, you know, the black away kit from a couple of years ago.
Oh, there you go.
Dagan's got on that one. Love it.
Nice. Dagan knew you were going to say that. So you've won the first choice. Dagan's won the second choice.
Exactly.
We love it. That is great continuity, Dagan. I appreciate that, Dagan. Thank you. So, yeah, we like to build everyone their profile as an Albion fan just before we get into an episode, just so, you know, people know the experiences that you've experienced as a fan and can really relate to you on that level. So thanks for that, guys. But let's, without further ado, get into the game against Everton, which was another 1-1 draw. And I guess let's start with the starting 11. Dagan, there were 5 changes. In come Verbruggen, Veltman, Van Heck, Gilmore and Milner. Out go Steele, Igor, Webster, Dahoud and Belieber. Were there any surprises for you from that?
It's hard to say anything's a surprise with the starting lineup at this point. I sigh. I scratch my head some. Milner, you know, again, wasn't particularly bad. He just wasn't especially good either for me. So, you know, I wasn't excited to see Milner. I'd really love to see Gross of the 10. I think, yeah, I mean, we'll talk more about the game. But I thought there were some obvious shortcomings that put us at risk that, all things considered, maybe didn't hurt us as badly as I feared they would. But we were not in a position to kind of take hold of the game in the way I think we would have liked either. But we'll talk more about that. So, wasn't upset. I was happy to see Verbruggen. I don't know if you're going to ask a separate question about the keeper situation. So I'll hold that. But I was happy to see Verbruggen out.
Yeah, that leads on lovely to my next question. Alex, we thought that we may have seen the end of the goalkeeper rotation. I think De Zerbi made a comment that it would be Jason Steele. However, Verbruggen has come in for an away game, I think for the second time or maybe the first time. I'm not 100% sure. So what's your take on the goalkeeper situation and the rotation there? Do you think it causes a problem, or do you just see it as they're both very capable?
Very good question, Joe, and very good timing because of what's recently happened with Jason Steele having his contract renewed this last week, which we've had a 3-year extension on. And I think everybody was very pleased to see the extension on the contract. Jason's performing well. He's only 32 years old. They're exactly the same birth date, both Steele and Verbruggen, but it's quite uncanny, that, isn't it? It's quite amusing. But, I mean, bless them. They've worked well together. They seem cohabitable, if that's a phrase. You know, they're able to live with one another. I think Bart was brought in under the in the knowledge that he would be rotated with Jason Steele. And that's been something which has been a relief for De Zerbi, because obviously what happened with Sanchez last season was a bit of an unmitigated disaster, frankly, for relations, you know. And those relations, when they go wrong, can actually infiltrate into the rest of the squad too, and our general overall camaraderie. So I was, in some senses, this season I've been quite pleased, because it's been a happy camp with De Zerbi managing the two keepers. And we all know, that they've got excellent qualities. The way they play, unfortunately, is a delicate thing, because to get up to speed and be able to have as much possession as what we require our keepers to do, as in we've not kicked a ball long from a goal kick this season once, and certainly that was the statistic 2-3 weeks ago. We may have had a long goal kick since, but you know, this is the way we like to play. And as a result of that, it puts enormous pressure on our keepers. My thoughts are, to answer your question, Joe, that I've been concerned about the rotation policy all season. And I raised this with the Brighton Bard earlier on the season. I asked him for his opinion on the matter. And he actually pushed back and said, Alex, I actually quite like the rotation policy. So we're in a bit of a mixed camp in terms of what our support feels. And I think that's the right reason why we've let De Zerbi get on with it without actually voicing our opinions too much as a fan base. Unfortunately, for Bart, he's made a few mistakes this season, perhaps a few more than Jason. But I think we should stick with both our keepers. Bart has had a bit of bad press as far as his Netherlands performances have gone in recent weeks. He's up against the Brentford number one. As who's going to be representing the Netherlands. And international presence is very good for their confidence, but I'm also aware that because he's not commanding number one spot for us on a daily week in, week out basis in the Premier League, I think we've got time with Bart. So to give Jason the number one spot for the rest of the season would not be a problem for me. And personally, for me, I would like to see Jason Steele as number one in the Premier League, and use Bart as our Europa League keeper and go back to a traditional method where we have a cup keeper and a Premier League keeper.
Yeah.
And then
we've
got time in the future to bring him back in, and then Jason can be, you know, switched back out, and we can change that to the other way around.
Yeah, no, that is certainly the method that most take. I've got a question. I've seen a lot of people saying, why have we spent £60 million on a goalkeeper if he's going to be an understudy? But I think you've raised some good points in that he's probably come in with the knowledge that he is going to be working under Jason Steele, a goalkeeper that De Zerbi really trusts, and is going to learn the system, because it is something different to ask of a goalkeeper to play the way that De Zerbi wants their goalkeepers to play. You know, you would only ever really see it from a Pep Guardiola-esque team, with Edison doing so well with the feet at the ball at his feet. Dagan, have you got a point?
So I want to clarify something, because I feel like this was a big misconception. Andy Naylor wrote an article, and the tweet, the sort of headline, was, I thought, pretty misleading. And then sort of later in the replies, he did clarify his meaning. but the headline implied that Steele had secured the number one job. And in fact, that wasn't the case. What DeZerbe said pretty clearly was that the regular rotation, meaning the two games on, two games off that we had seen, was no more. But not that Steele had secured it, just that we might see Steele for a run of three, four, five, six games. We might see Bart for a run of three, four, five, six games. We might see two and then one and then two again. He just made it clear that he was going to make the decision and it wasn't going to be the equal two and then two timeshare that we had had. And I feel like the fan base, you know, people read a headline and they move on. They don't read the full article or see the follow-up. But the follow-up was that those two guys are still competing. And I think if we see one have success, we'll ride the hot hand. I'm a little bit with Bard. I feel strongly like Verbruggen should get Premier League experience. He's going to be the guy. And if he's not going to be the guy, I think we'd rather find out sooner rather than later, because, you know, it'll be Rushworth or somebody else coming along. And, you know, Verbruggen is one of the most sought after players. If he's not the guy that can play in our system, I think he is. I think he has a ton of talent with his feet. He's just got to adjust to the speed of the Premier League. So I hope he keeps getting those chances and we keep seeing where they both are in different games. And if one beats the other out, so be it. But so far, I don't think there's been enough of a differential to call one way ahead. Verbruggen does have a few more mistakes. I think he also has a few more, you know, impressive stops. Context of the game maybe didn't make him seem as big, but he made some one-on-one saves early that were really, really impressive.
Yeah. Let's also talk about, James, the late change to the bench of Hinshelwood coming in and Lamptey missing out. And it looks like Tarik Lamptey will also be a doubt for Ajax and probably Sheffield United this weekend. Do you think we see Tarik Lamptey this side of Christmas, or do you think it's going to be another lengthy stay out?
Well, obviously, the only people that know that decision are the medical team in the squad, because they're the only ones that are looking at all the data. But you look at Brighton under Potter, and it's carried on to DeZerbe. If we can keep a player out of playing games for an extra 2, 3, 4 weeks or even a couple of months, but we can bring him back for an extra 6 months and sort of have a better rehab program and get them to a higher level to the point they're not going to re-injure, that's way better for us and for the player than re-injuring. It's like, if on the day you're thinking Lamptey's not going to be the right person, he's not feeling up to it, put in Hinshelwood. Because if Lamptey's not up to it, you're not going to sub him on. It's just a wasted spot. So you might as well put a youngster in.
James, can I put you on the spot? I'm going to ask you too, Alex, if that's all right, Joe. I want to know if you guys had to say your assuming Lamptey is out for a few weeks, your 1 and 2 option at left back and your 1 and 2 option at right back. Just curious.
James, you go first, mate.
Are we assuming that we've got Veltman still or not? So I'm going to say Veltman number one at right back. Believe it or not, I'm going to put Igor at left back. Potentially. I think you've also got the potential for one of the youngsters to come in. I think that's a bit more of a risk, but then, you know, you've seen Gross play fullback, so I'm going to put him on the left, and then, I mean, I hate to say it, but James Milner on the right, because he's been doing all right recently. But
Would you not swap that around and have Pascal on the right and James on the left? I think they've been playing more those two roles.
Believe it or not, I'd keep it as it is, because I think Gross plays quite well with Mitoma on the left.
No, that's fair. That's fair. Alex?
Well, I'm presuming we've got other people back. I mean, obviously, Purvis's opinion on the left was my number one all day long. If he's out, then this is the reason why we're having this conversation, because, you know, obviously it was great to see Tarik being able to switch across, because he's naturally a right-footed player and he handled it very well. And so did Solly March. March has more ability on the left anyway, naturally. But obviously, with an all-seeing, all-dancing squad, we can rotate Solly March, Tarik Lamptey, Joel Veltman, and James Milner left or right. all of them are quite capable of performing on the left or right, and Lamptey is, as you know, proven to do that as well. My number one, number twos, I mean, Joel Veltman can get caught short, and I do see a little bit of a morale issue with him if he gets riled up by some of the, shall we say, more competitive teams. I don't know whether you guys agree with me here, but I've seen teams get under his skin a little bit, the likes of Nottingham Forest, the likes of Brentford. And, you know, he can pick up a yellow card for reacting or kind of allowing the match circumstances to get the better of him. But I do really love Joel Veltman. So I would say him as a right back for me every day of the week, you know, and on the left side, James Milner right now, because I do feel like his experience brings a lot to the table that we can't replicate when Purvis is out. But I don't see a problem, actually, and this might be a bit left field, but I don't see a problem with playing Webster on a left-sided position of Dunk. Igor could be a new option for us here, but I think Webster's not been getting match time this season. Why not bring him on a little bit more? And we know he's injury prone. We know he can make a mistake, a stray pass once every 45 minutes. But he's an experienced player. He's one of them. He's one of the more senior players in our squad right now. And I think maybe we should use him a bit more.
I think what we're blessed with is the fact that we could. I think we've seen it actually against Fulham that we can go to a back three if we want to. And that is something that we've advocated for in this podcast, that Adam Webster is at his best in a back three, especially if he's alongside Lewis Duncan, JP Van Hecke, or even Igor has played really well in the back three before as well. And he can be that Colwell type. Yeah, sorry, go on, Alex.
I interrupt for one last point. Last season, we had a bit of a problem on our right-hand side with injuries as well. You'll remember, which is why Pascal Gross kept dropping back. We really noticed a difference when we lost Pascal from the midfield role, the holding roles, and the right-hand side role, you know, when Solly had an injury period. You know, we lost some control, our possession dropped. And I understand from James Dagan that, I'm not sure which one of you said it, but, you know, maybe use Pascal in one of those positions in the defensive line as a wing-back. For me, dropping Pascal back into the defence for a wing-back is a real shame. He gives us so much in the middle or in the midfield, on the right or the left, that he's too good to drop back. And that's what brings me back to last season. We had a player who called Afia. We didn't blood him in properly. I kept saying, why aren't we playing Afia? He's on the bench. Why don't we give him a chance at right-back? He came on for 5 minutes once at right back and held his own. And so sometimes I just feel like there's a bit of hesitancy and a resistance to actually blood a player that's not familiar with a right back or a left wing back position. And I think playing Webster in one of those positions for a half, he'd handle it.
Yeah, I think we've seen maybe like a period where Adam Webster has played a role at right back because the game circumstances allowed us to try that. And there was one moment where he went on a crazy run up the pitch, which you would probably never see if he wasn't given that freedom. And he looked like he was absolutely loving it. Tom has mentioned it many times on the podcast before as well. So it's not something that I would be against at all. So let's jump into the game. And it didn't take very long for Everton to cause us some problems with their physicality, Dagan. Let's just talk about the goal, because I think that's the elephant in the room. Mikalenko makes a massive run, completely unmarked and completely untracked, I would say. Gets into the box, the ball finds it is its way to him, and he's able to have two quick fire shots, one which was saved by Verbruggen quite well. And then the ball eventually finds its way into the back of the net off Lewis Dunk's knee. Dissect that goal for us, mate, and just sort of give us your view on, was it poor defending? Was it just unlucky that it came off Dunk's knee? Would Verbruggen would have saved it? Yeah, give us your insight.
I mean, I think it's a bit of both. I think it was a bit of poor defending and a bit of bad luck. maybe Verbruggen could have done better with the first ball, put it a little further out of trouble. But it was close range, quick reaction, tough to fault him, but so much. It just feels as much like just not being ready for what was obvious, that they were going to sit back, that they were going to counter. And we kind of gave the ball away cheaply. I think you can make a case. I mean, Lallana was certainly making a case that he was fouled in the loss of possession there. They never really showed it back that far because it was a couple of, there were a couple of additional passes in the buildup before that point. So I never really got a good look at whether I thought he was, whether he was fouled or not. I did watch the game back, and even the second time through, I didn't, I wasn't convinced that he was or wasn't. But I certainly could tell that he, he threw his arms up in the air. He thought he'd been fouled. But I know we were talking about in the chat, Tom felt like he went over pretty easily. And again, I mean, when we're caught out and the guys we have in, to run people down are not anyone capable of running people down, we're going to struggle in those moments. And, Baleba is really the only guy we can put in the midfield that has that kind of, speed to close. Very, very quickly. Gilmore runs hard and is quick, but he doesn't hit top speed incredibly fast. That was the kind of goal that, I didn't see it happen live. You guys know I was traveling and watched later, but it was the kind of goal that you would have expected when you saw the team sheet, at least for me. so that's my breakdown.
Yeah. James, do you feel like if anyone was at fault, was it Veltman? Was it Van Hek? I think Veltman was caught out of position. If you were to place the blame anyway, if you are going to place the blame, or is it just a freak goal to concede with Mykolenko as a left back?
I wouldn't place the blame on anyone, but I can't remember the exact players. But, two players sort of go in on Mykolenko almost to cause a foul so that he can't carry on his run. They both end up on the floor, and all of a sudden you've got two players that have committed are now on the floor. They've got to get up to start tracking back. One of those players, if you look at it, probably should have been the ones that were to track back, but someone else needs to then track back afterwards. But it's very difficult if you're trying to mark when you're waiting for someone else to track back. They're not there. What are you supposed to do? Obviously, Mykolenko then makes his way into the box, which you should never be an unmarked player with the ball, essentially, coming into the box. He's had one shot. Verbruggen's done quite well to save it. But if it's falling straight back to him, someone should be on him instantly, making a second challenge. It's unfortunate it comes off Dunk's knee, because otherwise I think, Verbruggen's got a chance of saving it. But don't let the second shot come in, I think.
Yeah, no, you're right. And I think JP sort of commits himself a little bit too much, and then Mykolenko is able to get himself away and get the shot away. Let's get into the part where I'm going to get angry, Dagan, and Alex and James, because there was another absolutely atrocious VAR call. I don't know if you guys feel the same. I hope you do, because if you don't, I will have serious questions. So I think it's Simon Adingra that wins the free kick, which Pascal Gross floats in absolutely beautifully for our captain to smash home. And it's probably one of, or if not, would have been the goal of the season. I thought it was an absolutely fantastically crafted goal. And VAR, again, second season in a row, has ripped away the chance for a goal to be a goal of the season contender for no reason whatsoever. I had a little bit of a discussion with Tom in the group chat, the Albion Obsessed group chat, that he was sort of at the end of the game blaming the fact that we couldn't finish, and that I completely get where he's coming from. And I was saying, but why is there not Spurs-level anger? Like Spurs-level anger from last season when those five calls went against us. For me, this is just as atrocious as any of those decisions that were made. The technology that we have in this league, the best league in the world, and we're to be held accountable for it as well, because we were one of the clubs that denied automated offsides or semi-automated offsides coming into the league. How has that not been done yet, Alex? Because We are the best league and probably one of the richest leagues in the world. How are we still relying on extremely pixelated images and cameras that can't even pick up the correct frame from which the ball was kicked to measure the offside, and camera angles that don't they're not even in line with the pitch? How is that allowed to happen with this much at stake?
Joe, you've summarized it very well, and you've actually highlighted quite a few of the issues surrounding it. You're right. We're all absolutely devastated. I think our fan base, as we saw under Graham Potter, is a very respectful fan base, and we're not as loud, you know, sometimes as we perhaps should be. Jamie Carragher's come out and criticised Mikel Arteta only this morning, saying the Arsenal official club should not have come out as aggressively as they have about the Newcastle defeat. You know, and there's a lot of conversation at the moment in the media about pros and cons of criticizing, you know, the system and the officials, certainly was in terms of VAR. So, but for us, yeah, I am absolutely with our fan base on this 100%. Those that are aggrieved, you've got a right to be aggrieved. It was a travesty against Everton. Lewis Dunk scored perhaps the best goal of his life. You know, for a defender to strike that with his left foot, I mean, it was a goal out of boyhood dreams. You know, to see the pixelated images, to have the line drawn clearly not from his shoulder. You know, people are saying, you know, the shoulder, if you draw that line up, carry it up to the shoulder, and, you know, then the shoulder is a part of the playing, you can conceivably score from a shoulder. No, the line was on the hand. At best, it was pixelated anyway. You know, the semi-automated technology that's not being brought in. Why hasn't it been brought in? You know, this is a decision that the FA has made clearly at the beginning of the season, and apparently it's going to be extended to 2024, 2025 as well. I mean, you know, we're not up to speed with the technologies there. What I want to say is the technology is there, but it's not being actually installed. The cameras should run in line with the goal, in line with the offside decision, not off at an angle. So if the cameras aren't there and they're not able to track, you know, like a linesman would run the line, if they're not able to keep up to speed and have a straight line, then they shouldn't be installed at all. And they shouldn't be relied upon. And this used to be, you know, beyond reasonable doubt sort of ruling. That seems to be neglected now. There's no more beyond reasonable doubts with this. It's like, well, if it's not beyond reasonable doubt, the goal should stand. Now they're giving they're overruling goals that are just grey areas. And you know, we saw it in the Newcastle game against Arsenal. Did that ball go out? You know, arguably, you can argue the same for us a few weeks before when we kept the ball in and we scored. But you know, the technology is there for goal line technology. So it should be there for generally around all areas of the pitch, certainly in an opposition's half, when the ball's in a grey area, has it gone out or not? And likewise, the pixelated images should be stopped. There should be more officials sat in the VAR room. Why are there only two or three? They should take more time if they need to. You know, these are decisions that can cost clubs millions and millions of pounds. You know, so I'm devastated. And actually, the last point I'd like to make on this, guys, is the reason why people are so angry about this is because Dunk scored that goal that was disallowed in something like we were still in the 20s. It was like 25th minute or something, 26th.
I think it was the 14th minute.
14th, was it? Wow. Pretty well, sure. Thank you, David.
14th, 15th, yeah.
It changed the nature of the game. And this is what people need to understand. If we'd gone 1-1 at that point in time in the game, we would have our possession, which, by the way, was a record since 2003, 78% possession in this game against Everton, with only seven shots, by the way. So the statistic is 78% possession against seven shots. No one's done that in the Premier League since 2003, pre-Premier League days, when I think it was Chelsea against Nottingham Forest. So, you know, we're breaking new territory in terms of our possession. But, you know, can you imagine how Everton's heads would have gone down if we'd got that goal? The game could have been very different. And that's a subconscious side of football that can't be quantified. It can't be translated onto a pitch. It can't be translated into a highlights show. And we the game may have changed. Their formation structure may have changed. Their confidence may have dropped. But they are able to carry on playing in the style Sean Dyche set them up in. And I think the nature of the game changed. And it's not fair that to say that it was a 1-1 was a fair result. Because we may have gone on to win that game by 2 or 3 goals.
Yeah, I think you're right, Alex, and that's the point that I was making. And you know, it's all if, buts, and maybes, but we never had the opportunity to see what would have happened from that. Dagan, I just want to talk about the technology itself, because whilst the technology is there and should be used correctly by the people, the technology, I think, is not up to speed whatsoever. I'm talking about the pixelated images, and people are going to think I'm nitpicking here, but how can you have a Premier League stadium with, you know, so much on the line, recording on what I can only assume is a potato? They should have 8K cameras, 16K cameras. This is the most watched league in the world. And they can't even afford to have cameras that can zoom up to see whether an arm is in line with a knee. When does this incompetence stop?
The views I'm about to express do not reflect Albion Obsessed or my employer. I don't have answers. I have questions. Here are my questions. You've alluded to some of them already. One, why does the best league in the world, with players and managers from all over the world, only have English officials in the game, on the sideline, on VAR? Why does the best league in the world not use the best technology for automating these decisions and increasing accuracy? Why does the best league in the world not take advantage of the transparency utilized in other leagues within this sport and in other sports, notably rugby, in the same country? What's the criteria for evaluating these officials? How do they get to the Premier League? By the same note, how do they get removed from the Premier League? Major League Baseball is showing accuracy stats for all their umpires now. It's to the public, everybody can see it, right? VAR overrules on-field officials, so we know what officials are making lots of mistakes on the pitch. And then we get a report when VAR makes an error and often apologies. Why not track these things? Why not have there be consequences for people who are making, you know, completely backwards decisions with great regularity? Right? Stuart Atwell, Michael Oliver, like we've heard the same names over and over and over again, right? Like it would just be interesting to know what these processes are and what's being done to fix it other than we're working on it. These, you know, seem to be competent people who, you know, should be up to the task. And if they're not, I think we need to look elsewhere to find people who are. But there are questions that should have easy answers, right? But they may not. Tom suggested in our messaging that there's arrogance at play here and nothing more. And this case is made all the time that, you know, it all evens out. It all evens out. It all evens out. It hasn't evened out. No other club has gotten an apology for the mistake that gave Brighton 3 points. Am I wrong there? Right? So if it's evening out, when are those apologies going to come to, you know, to City or Man U when they lose a game to us on a mistaken call? Are we going to see a handful of those in succession to even things out? I'll venture to you that that won't happen. And if it does, it will happen where we're sitting somewhere between 10th and 13th. It's not going to happen when we're in 7th. That call it what you will, call it bias, call it, you know, a word that I won't say. But there are reasonable questions to be asked. I'd love to talk with someone who could have answers from a position of authority about the whys, why that technology is not implemented, why we aren't doing better. It just doesn't make sense. There's no reasonable explanation for it. The explanations that make sense are ugly, and damning, frankly. So that's my answer. I don't know if it's an answer. It's just lots of questions.
No, they're very good questions to pose. James, I'm going to throw you a question. Put yourself in this situation. You are the person that tomorrow you can make the decision whether VAR is scrapped from football completely and never comes back, or VAR stays and we wait for it to improve. What decision do you make?
I'm going to make a decision here, and bear with me on this. I've got some reasoning behind it. VAR stays, but it needs some alterations to it. Offsides, right? It's a game played by humans, officiated by humans. That means there's going to be human errors. With an offside decision, if I'm looking down the line and someone is that far offside, I can't see that with my eyes. You can't see that on a computer screen. So you have to go with the on-field decision like they do in rugby. In rugby, if you don't have a decision on field and... Sorry, if you do have a decision on field, you go away, you don't know what to do. You stick with the on-field decision. We don't have that in football, if you're unsure. VAR is a tool. It depends how you use it. You look at rugby, again, I know I'm talking a lot about rugby, but you've got a few guys, say three or four guys up in the TMO, they call it, but essentially VAR. One member of that team talks to the referee. They're not all talking, one member does. Then on the field, the referee is the only one that talks to the TMO. Do the same as football, because you've heard the recordings where they're all shouting at each other, like at the Tottenham game. If you just have two people talking to each other, that just eliminates the confusion of it, if you ask me. You look at how it's done in the World Cup. If you can copy that across into the Premier League, you're going to be doing so much better. You look at recently Jurgen Klopp and Arteta, obviously Liverpool and Arsenal, have both said, look, we're the best league in the world. How comes we haven't got the best referees in the world? They've said that. It's only going to take one or two more clubs until you get that point across. You know, the refereeing standard, it doesn't have to be consistent across all referees. It just has to be consistent, but like in the match. Cause, you know, there's countless times that in a match, a VAR decision's given in one place, but not in another, or given in one game, but not another game. All we're asking is consistency at the same level, if you ask me. So I'd say VAR stays, but it needs some changes.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. It's the complete incompetence is the thing that baffles me, and is the fact that why have we got to wait for Erik ten Hag to say it? Why do we have to wait for Pep Guardiola to say it? Why are we waiting for more people to stand up against it? I think Tom raised a really good point yesterday when we were chatting, and he said what sort of stand it would make if a decision like yesterday happens, and it's very clear to see that it's the incorrect decision. What would happen if the team literally just walked off the pitch? What would they do? They would have to make a change. And I think Tom also said you can't only get angry when it's against your team, and he's 100% right. And this is why we should be angry and continually be angry until there is change made, because it's ruining football for me. There's been so many times over the last couple of seasons where we've scored and I've been like, do I celebrate? And it takes the love out of it. It takes the passion away. Sorry, Dagan, go on.
No, I meant to say this. Like, whenever you say, you know, that there's a possibility of something, you know, that's not above board, people dismiss it. And they always have. In 2002 in the NBA, when, you know, the Lakers took a game from the Kings that people just thought this was horrendous. This was the most awful officiating they've ever seen. And then, you know, if you're following Netflix, I don't know how well you follow the NBA, but the Tim Donaghy scandal, right? That game was fixed. It was rigged by the officials. And, you know, it happened in plain sight and was dismissed because the Lakers were the Lakers and the Kings were the Kings. The Kings were not supposed to beat the Lakers, right? The Lakers are a big money team. The Lakers are going to win that game. you know, I don't know that we know the whole story and who was involved and who knew what, right? We just know that Tim Donaghy took money and fixed that game. People say, well, you know, it can't happen. It happens. And I venture for every time you find out about something like that, it happens hundreds and hundreds of times. And the number of gambling and betting scandals that are coming out with players, it's undercutting and eroding the confidence in the game. When you can provide transparency, given all of that, it's only sensible and responsible to do it. And if you're not providing that transparency, it just leads people to question. Alex, you had a hand up.
Very good point. I think, Dagan, thank you for that. And I think, personally, as a fan, when we had our match kind of ruined for us last season against Spurs, you know, I was absolutely devastated. And I think everybody in this podcast will be, and all of our fan base was. And again, Joe, I agree with you. Sometimes I say to my partner, you know, and whoever's with me at a match, you know, I might not be able to follow the Albion as seriously as moving forward anymore because I'm getting hurt. You know, I'm feeling pain from this. And it does impact us emotionally. It does impact us, you know, in many levels. And which, very good point about taking that mantra to other matches when you see VAR upsetting, you know, Arsenal against Newcastle, or if Spurs get a lucky, decision in their favour again, you know, why not get upset about it, even if it's not the Albion? But I think the C word, the corruption word, Dagan, is a difficult one, and it is tricky because, you know, actually after the Spurs game last season, I actually coined a phrase when what was being bandied about, but I actually liked the phrase. It was unconscious bias, you know, and, you know, the phrase, the big six, was brought into it. You know, is there unconscious bias against the Albion and teams like us, you know, that were knocking on the Europa door at the time? And, you know, at the time I was explaining to some of my Newcastle United fans, friends who are living up in the northeast of England, you know, that I thought Brighton and Hove Albion were unfairly treated, you know, and the thing about unconscious bias is it goes beyond, you know, what we're aware of. It could be lying dormant within an official and they don't even know that they've got it themselves. And that could be in the VAR room or it could be on the pitch as one of the main officials. So, you know, humans, going back to James's point, we are dealing with humans. Old school, you know, Alex Ferguson days, people might say, you know, did Manchester United deserve as much success as they got back in the day? You know, controversy, of course, raising these issues historically, but, you know, you only have to speak to Gary Neville and he'll probably tell you, or read some of his reviews and articles, and he'll tell you, we did get lucky. You know, match bias did exist, you know. Jamie Carragher would probably agree with him. But corruption and going beyond that level now, it goes back to the VAR system as to why it's not been brought in as a semi, you know, autonomous system. The technology is there. You know, why aren't we deploying that technology? Why are the FA delaying that technology for the Premier League right now? I mean, I ask you that question because it's there. And money comes into this potentially. You know, why is the 3 p.m. blackout still in existence for the Premier League? You know, when Dagan's able to watch it in America, why aren't we allowed to watch our own matches? You know, obviously we understand the argument that it's nice to see stadiums full up and down the country, but the technology is there. You know, these teams that aren't in the Premier League, they could probably benefit financially from having their matches televised as well. You know, so money is part of this and it goes beyond the nature of the FA, the structure of the way it's built, the board's members on the FA, the committee, the age of the, you know, a lot of things are coming to fruition in recent years. Changes are being made. Women's football is being viewed very differently to what it was even 2 years ago, you know. So I think we're in a transition period, and I don't think this VAR controversy is going to carry on forever, Joe. I really hope so anyway, because I, for one, couldn't put up with what we're seeing right now, long term.
Yeah, no, I think you're spot on. James, you had the point?
Just taking it back to sort of the officiating side of things. This is away from VAR, away from the C word, all that kind of stuff. You look at the game against Fulham, right? And you see players going down left, right and centre. Now, the rules are black and white on this. If it's a head injury or if it's a serious injury, and I mean serious, right, to the point, you know, you look at Jimenez's injury a few years ago where someone's unconscious on the floor, or Ericsson, someone's just collapsed. That's what constitutes a serious injury. A serious injury isn't you've had a knock, you're on the floor, and you're in a little bit of pain, right? The ref is constantly just stopping the game in the Fulham game over and over and over again. You know, if it's a black and white rule, why aren't we following it that way? It's like, there's so many times that the refs just don't follow the rules when it comes to someone being down. It's like, the rule is, as soon as the physio or anyone from the medical team steps onto the pitch, the player that's injured has to go off, right? The amount of times I've seen them start running onto the pitch and run off, right, is just disregarding the rules. The rules are there for a reason. Follow them. Even for us, I admit, like, we've had our physios run onto the pitch and the player hasn't go off. And you're just like, it's just the rule. Just follow it.
Yeah, I think the referees are too, I don't know, that they're too much in their heads as to what they think is right for the game and how they think the game should flow, etc. And it's just an absolute shambles from top to bottom. And Alex, I really hope you're right that it doesn't continue for much longer. However, let's not dwell on the situation. Actually, no, I just really quickly, to close this VAR segment, want to read a quote from the Albion Roar, who tweeted, given that VAR has plenty of previous in this, having seen the quality of the image, the fact that it was judged from after Gross kicked the ball and the guesswork of lines, I'm far from convinced Dunk was offside. At best, it's ambiguous, meaning the goal should have stood. And that quote for me sums it up absolutely perfectly. But as I say, let's not dwell on it for too long, and let's talk about the goal, Dagan, because we had to wait a while for us to draw level in this game, and that it comes from a magical run from Otoma, who, you know, beats a man for pace and gets down the wing, drives in a lovely ball, and Ashley Young can't do anything but get his leg in the way and it loops over Pickford. It was a long wait for a goal, Dagan.
Yeah, I mean, that's, we gave Everton a lot of time to keep their shape. And when they have their shape, they're very effective. That goal was the result of a very quick reversal. Dahoud made a quick turn, played a left-footed pass over the top of the defense, taking advantage of the fact that they had, you know, over-rotated to our overload on the right-hand side. And when he played that pass over the top into space, Matoma had something he didn't have a lot of. He had a one-on-one. He had a bunch of one-on-twos in the game and created some opportunities out of those. But one-on-one, we're in business, right? And again, it was just a cross, but it looked a better chance than we might have had. But it turned into something much more fortuitous than just a chance and a nice cross. But I think we just weren't direct enough, and we didn't reverse the ball quickly enough against that type of defense. And I've seen a couple articles today that reflected as much, and I thought they were spot on, because that's what you have to do. And I think, you know, I thought better once we had João Pedro, because he can sneak between those little tight spaces, and make a compact defense look more open and vulnerable than they do. But that's not a characteristic of Gilmore. That's not a characteristic of Gross carrying the ball. That's not a characteristic of Lallana carrying the ball, right? I mean, those guys are going to play the right passes and make the right decisions, but they're not going to sort of maneuver through tight spaces with the ball on their feet. And I thought, you know, in an effort to not give away possession, which is what allowed us to end up with nearly 80% possession in the game, we made a ton of very, very safe passes. And I think because of that, we didn't create many chances. And I think that's why, you know, maybe why they only scored one goal on the counter, but also why we only had seven shots on goal. So that's the difference, right? I mean, people, you know, bemoan when we give the ball away cheaply and the team, other team goes the other way. But you can't have it both ways. Either you're an attack and try to create a lot of chances, which makes you more vulnerable, or you're going to be more patient, deliberate, and have fewer chances, and you hope the quality of those chances, you know, lead to goals. The reality of this game, you know, the chance that we did score on, maybe we didn't deserve to. We did score on one chance and had it taken away. That's the only thing at the end of the day that I can live with, is it feels like, well, maybe one goal is really what we deserved out of this game. We just got it by means that perhaps not the one that we most deserved. So it was a great chance. We capitalized, we got lucky, but the ball went back in the net. You know, some could say it wasn't all that different from their goal, right? Weird deflection, ball goes in. This probably weirder. That was at least an intended shot on target for them that was deflected into the net. Ours was not. But yeah, when it went in, as I was driving down the road, I was hopeful that we were going to turn things around and get another. When I watched it, it really felt like we might. I don't know if you guys felt that way, but it felt like we might steal one. And alas.
Yeah, there's always that hope with the Roberto De Zerbi side that when they get a goal, that they are they have a spring in their step and go on to get another. For us, I feel like when we do score, the floodgates do somewhat open, and that pressure comes off us searching for that ever-wandering goal. Alex, you mentioned a rather unfortunate stat, and Dagan just sort of alluded to it as well. A quote from De Zerbi after the game was, "We need to shoot more." Do you think Brighton were really the masters of their own downfall on Saturday afternoon?
I think with Robert De Zerbi's rotation policy, it's very difficult to build a consistency within the team. And one thing which I've noticed over the last three or four games is that Evan Ferguson, unfortunately, even though I love him, unfortunately, Evan Ferguson has not been the Evan Ferguson that we may have seen earlier in the season. Joao Pedro came on against Everton and, frankly, performed a lot better. Evan, and this has been picked up by commentary teams, summarizers and analysts, potentially has had an illness, which has led to a confidence drop and somewhat sort of shell-shocked on the pitch at times, not tracking back or as he may, or even though he is a 10, you know, Joao Pedro, and, you know, if you look back at classic Shearer-esque qualities, you know, if you're out of the game, you go and get the ball. You know, unfortunately, at times he does look out of touch. And we know this can happen in football, especially when we're playing with a De Zerbi midfield that's tweaked week after week. You know, is Dahu going to start this week, or is it going to be Lallana? Is it going to be Gilmore? Is it going to be, you know, Gross in the middle, or is Gross going to play on the right? You know, variations left, right and centre, which can disrupt our consistency and our regularity. And I felt that it all infiltrates into how many shots we're having. I do feel like the disallowed dunk goal had a huge impact on the game. Dagan, to touch on what Dagan said, you know, should we be happy with one? Or, of course, we're delighted. We got the point. You know, we're playing Everton. We've got a terrible record against Everton over the years. In fact, it's one of our worst nemesis teams. You know, if you look back at Brighton's history, we're absolutely humbled by Everton and delighted to get a point against them. And they are a very great team with a lot of history. And, you know, we're blessed to be in the Premier League, etc. Nobody's taking our gratefulness away from us as Albion fans. But that game could have been very different if Dunk's goal had been allowed. So going back to the VAR decision, I don't think the seven shots would have been seven shots, Joe, if we'd had that goal allowed and if we'd been allowed to play freely, which would have happened. Unfortunately, you know, negativity gets into the mindset. Even where we had possession, it impacted us. Everton was still able to play free-flowing football
despite their possession statistics, and keep their Sean Dyche tactics. And De Zerbi's flowing football can be countered with a good defensive management. And we've seen that with Nottingham Forest. We've seen it with Fulham. We've seen it with Everton now. We've seen it with Crystal Palace, with Roy Hodgson's teams. You know, it's not difficult to counter a De Zerbi team with a defensive strategy. And, you know, that don't read too much into the shots, in my opinion. I'm not going to get negative about our shot tally, because we were playing some pretty football. And I do feel like Mitoma can have that one moment a match where he's able to do what he did. Mitoma, sometimes you look at him and you think, he's off form. What's wrong with Mitoma? He's not done anything all game. And then he'll go ahead and do that on the 85th minute. And that's why we love him. And, you know, I'm very pleased to have him in our team, and I hope we can keep him next season. But generally speaking, I wouldn't be...
Yeah.
I just want to make a quick note, because I've been meaning to say this for a while, and you brought it to my attention, Alex. Ferguson and João Pedro first started in the Newcastle game together. Well, that went rather well. 3-0 lead. They got a late one back. But in the 77 minutes they played together, we had all three of our goals through 70 minutes with those two playing together, and Ferguson had a hat trick. They didn't play in a Premier League game again as starters until Liverpool, where again we scored first. Now we did concede in that game, and we didn't get the equalizer until I can't remember which Ferguson, until Ferguson had come off. But those are two pretty good results from the two games that we started those two guys together in the Premier League. Those are the only two out of 11 games where we started arguably our best nine and our best 10 together. I mean, to your point about rotation, you would think you would look at that Newcastle result and say, boy, maybe we should get this group together more often. Now we can't have Solly on the right because he's out. And, you know, I've said before, I'd like to see someone other than Adingra or Bonanate on the right. I'd love to see Ansu Fati try it out over on the right, or maybe even João Pedro over on the right and put Gross at the 10. But yeah, I just want to make that point, because I don't know that it's an either or with Ferguson and João. I think perhaps we're at our best when those two are out there together because of what they do for each other. Things get a lot easier when you've got a guy like João Pedro out there. And I think Ferguson needs someone to draw some attention, because when all the attention's on him in the center of the park, that's a lot to deal with as a 19-year-old, 18-year-old kid.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point, Dagan. I think that, you know, we tried to play Lallana in a position that would support Ferguson against Everton. And, you know, we all know Lallana is a maestro when it comes to final delivery and a clever little bit of skill that can lead on to a goal, and potentially, you know, Lallana, this is why Lallana finds himself in shooting positions so often. You know, he is an absolute genius. Unfortunately, it didn't happen against Everton. I didn't feel like Lallana had a bad game, but he was unable to put his usual stamp on the performance. I would have liked to have seen Balaba start. I think he's potentially being carefully managed because of his age, because of the cramp that we saw him have last when he was playing for 90 minutes, when he's not used to playing that length of match. And you know, I think we should bring on Balaba a little bit cautiously, so we don't risk any injury. He's got so much potential; it's phenomenal. And he could be our new key, certainly for the replacement for Caicedo, or a defensive midfielder position, which can, you know, because as well as being able to score goals, we've seen he's got an attacking streak in him, which is fantastic. But I'd love to see more of Pedro with Ferguson. You know, I was at the Newcastle game, and I agree with you. The two go hand in hand. Welbeck is our super sub, so why not start with those two? We all know Danny is fantastic coming off the bench. You know, obviously Evans done well coming off the bench too, but, you know, I'd actually love to see that too. I actually do feel like Simon Adingra is a good prospect. I think he needs more time. I generally think he is our new Mitoma on the right. I'd love to see him. I think he could be switched with Mitoma as well. Give Mitoma a bit of a break. We've overplayed him. We saw him have fatigue again, you know, and pull out of the Japanese internationals recently. Let's be a little bit cautious. Now we have Adingra to mix and match. Let's run those two. And actually Mitoma on the right, it really confuses defenses as well. So, you know, I'd like to see a bit more variation with those two.
Yeah, definitely. James, if you're Roberto De Zerbi going into the Ajax game, who are the pair that you put together for the attacking lineup, the 9 and the 10? Do you agree with Dagan?
I agree that they play very well together. I am not going to deny that. But we've got so many games. I would argue that there are two best strikers. And if you're playing them together, who are you going to play in the other games when both of them are having a rest? Is my question. Personally, I think João Pedro against Ajax. Ferguson potentially off the bench because Pedro is just so quick at making darting runs, even with Fatty next to him. I know that Fatty, I believe he played against Ajax in the home leg. He didn't have the, you know, I wouldn't say he didn't have the best game. Oh yeah, he did score that goal, sorry. He for the rest of the game, he wasn't playing the best, in my opinion. But next to Pedro, they just work well because they're so both so quick that they press the defence really well. So I'd put those two up top again, yeah. With what Fatty like, just behind.
What I like about Ansu Fati is that there is that that Barcelona stardom attached to him, that he can pull out those incredible moments when you need them the most. The goal against Marseille away, header, you know, that chance just before half time was a fantastic header, and I wish that had gone in because that was utterly unbelievable. So good that I thought it did go in. And the goal against Ajax was from another planet. The ball from Adingra, the smart finish into the far corner, that's what Ansu Fati gives us. And, you know, let's not forget that Ansu Fati has predominantly played out wide for Barcelona. And is known to be a creative player on the wing position. So I don't think we should be against trying him out at right wing if Adingra needs a rest or if Mitoma needs a rest. So there's lots to tinker with. Before we move on to look ahead or get our predictions for Ajax, let's get our player of the match for the Everton game. So Dagan, can you pick me a player of the match, please?
That's really tough for this game. Pass, come back to me.
Okay, Alex.
Well, you put us on the spot here, Joe. I actually think, well, it's a good question, Joe. There wasn't anybody that stood out, and I didn't think it was Evan Ferguson, that's for sure. I mean, I don't think Dunk put a foot wrong the entire game. I think he scored and he deserved to get man of the match for that goal. And it should have been remembered. And if he had scored that goal, he would have been man of the match. So I'd like to say Lewis Dunk.
There you go, Dunky. You've got the Albion obsessed man of the match from Alex, so you can put that on your mantelpiece instead of the goal of the season award. James, can you pick me a player of the match if you can think of one?
I'm going to go for Mitoma. He's had a moment of magic which got us our goal, but he's just reminding us what he can do. I mean, he just bamboozles defenders just instantly. 1-2 touch, he's gone, and he puts you in that position. But he may not have had the best game overall, but he gave us that moment that scored us our goal.
Yeah, that's fair. And did you know Mitoma done a thesis on dribbling? I'm not going to bore you with that. That's
I know
been told
he did.
Way too many times. Dagan, have you thought of a name yet, or are we going to be here until next week?
No, I mean those were the two, and I'm kind of split between the two. I think those are the two you make a case for. I lean more Dunk because I feel like he probably deserved a goal more than Mitoma did. To Alex's point, so I'll say undecided, leaning Dunk. Just a rough game.
Fair enough. No. I think I'm going to even it up, and I'm going to agree with James and say Karim Mitoma. That one moment of magic that gets us the goal and gets us a point away. Go on, Dagan.
Honorable mention for Dahoud for the pass.
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's completely fair. Yeah, let's even it up, as I say. Let's give it to Mitoma. And just moving on as well, we weren't the only first team in action this weekend, with Brighton and Hove Albion women's team also taking on Manchester United at Crawley. And we're just going to cut away for Dan to give us the rundown of what happened in that game. So over to Dan.
Welcome, Albion Obsessed and WSL fans. What a thrilling match we witnessed at the Broadfield Stadium, where Brighton faced off against Manchester United. I'm Dan, and today we're recapping this exciting encounter that ended in a 2-2 draw. Stick around as we break down the team news, key moments, controversies, and more. Let's get started. Before we get into the action, let's take a look at the team news and some other pre-match stats to set the stage. Brighton made 4 changes to their lineup, with Turland, Zigiotti, Haley, and Simmons returning. In terms of recent history, Brighton hadn't beaten United in the WSL before today, and they were looking to end that streak. Now, let's talk about a little delay there was prior to kickoff. The start of the match was actually delayed by around 10 minutes due to congestion outside of the ground. What that meant is that was delaying the arrival of the ambulance and paramedics that need to attend every football game. It was unexpected, but of course, completely out of the club's control. What was a little bit frustrating is that nobody inside the stadium knew what was going on. Yeah, let's see if we can do a bit better. Let's see if we can get some communication in the stadium or onto Twitter or something. The stadium was absolutely packed with nearly 3,500 fans in the stands. It was fantastic to have the stadium so busy to watch Brighton take on United. And although many of the supporters were there to cheer on United, it's really encouraging to see such a crowd turn out on a freezing Sunday night. The first half of this thrilling encounter saw Man United coming out really strongly. They peppered the Brighton goal with numerous attempts trying to break the deadlock. Sophie Bagley, our rock at the back, was on fire. And in the 3rd minute, she made a huge save against Millard's fierce shot from point-blank range, despite Sophie's sight being impaired. That set the tone, I think, for her brilliant performance. She was absolutely on fire yesterday. Brighton, though, weren't about to be outdone. In the 20th minute, we nearly took the lead when Bremer sent out a cross that almost looped over Earps and into the back of the net, but the woodwork saved United's blushes. The game was finally poised. But then came the moment we'd all been waiting for. Well, all the Brighton fans. In the 30th minute, Turland, who's been on fire recently, found the back of the net with a clinical finish. It was a moment of exceptional coaching from Phillips. And you could really see that every player knew exactly what their role was supposed to be in that goal. You could tell by the celebrations. The crowd erupted. It was 1-0 to Brighton. As the game progressed, the tension was building. United were absolutely desperate for an equaliser, and they kept pushing. In the 44th minute, they almost scored as a corner caught Brighton off guard. Bagley made an incredible save. Again, I think we're going to see a bit of a theme here. She tipped the ball onto the bar. Turner pounced on the rebound, but Bagley thwarted her as well with some acrobatic goalkeeping. A fantastic double save from her. The second half saw Manchester United coming out pretty strongly. They continued to apply pressure, but the Brighton defence held strong, with Bagley putting on a goalkeeping masterclass. However, the game took a turn when Toon scored a fantastic equaliser in the 78th minute. It was an absolutely stunning goal. If you were there, if you saw it, you'll know what I mean. It was a peach. The one slightly sour note about it, though, I mean, apart from the fact that it was an equaliser against Brighton, was that general consensus within the stadium, and it seems online, was that there was a pretty clear foul in the build-up to that, which the referee saw and waved on or didn't notice. But either way, it wasn't pulled back, and the goal was awarded. It was 1-1. The match remained pretty intense, with both teams creating opportunities. Brighton had their fair share of near misses, hitting the bar and forcing Earps into some really impressive saves. But Bagley, again, wow, just save after save. She was absolutely exceptional. Brighton, though, continued to apply pressure, and in the 84th minute, Brighton were all over United. One of the most stunning opportunities emerged, though, when a Brighton corner was cleared and the ball found its way to Julia Zagotti just outside of the box. She stood on the edge of the area and, with incredible technique, unleashed a wonderful dipping volley that had everyone on the edge of their seats, pretty much. The ball flying through the air. It looked destined for the back of the net, but it was not to be. Earps saw it coming, leapt and managed to tip the ball onto the bar. It was an incredible save, really, under immense pressure, and you can really appreciate why she is England's number one. To see it, though, saved was absolutely gutting. We didn't, however, need to wait too long for something else to cheer about, as in the 88th minute, Brighton finally found their second breakthrough. The tension in the stands was palpable as Brighton won a corner with just minutes left on the clock. This was really the last chance we had to seal a victory or to seal something. Everyone held their breath. As the corner swung in, the entire Broadfield Stadium seemed to focus on one player, Bergsvind. The Swedish international had been a towering presence throughout the match, and she rose majestically to meet the delivery. With impeccable timing and power, Bergsvind directed the ball into the back of the net. The crowd erupted in a mixture of disbelief in the United end and jubilation in the Brighton. Earps, the United keeper, was beaten again. As we headed into extra time, the tension in the stadium was at its peak. Brighton had fought valiantly and the fans were hopeful of a historic victory, but United had other plans. In the 98th minute of the seven added minutes, Man United were awarded a corner. It was a moment of immense pressure for both teams, with Brighton's faithful praying for a heroic defensive stand. As the corner was delivered, the Brighton defence did their best to clear the danger. However, fate had a different script. The ball was inadvertently flicked on, and it found its way to Williams, the super sub, who had already made her mark this season. I think she's scored about four goals off the bench, which is, incredible. No one's doubting the talent that United have in their team, in their side at the moment. Williams was free at the back post. She calmly tapped the ball into the net. The Broadfield Stadium, which had been filled with hope and anticipation just moments earlier, was silenced by this late, late equaliser. It was absolutely gutting. After playing so brilliantly and conceding a goal so late, it just felt harsh. I'd have taken a point before the match, but when that goal went in, it felt like it was 2 points lost. Ultimately, though, I think what cost us wasn't the coaching, wasn't the players, wasn't the tactics, or even really United. What cost us is the refereeing, the referee allowing a foul to go unpunished, which directly led to United scoring their first goal, and the referee allowing the game to run to nearly 100 minutes, despite an already excessive seven being added. Now, enough with the doom and gloom. Time to talk about the standout performers in this thrilling encounter. For me, it's a toss-up between Bagley and Bergsvind. Bagley's heroic saves and Bergsvind's defensive solidarity were both crucial for Brighton today. It's a tough decision, but I think I'm going to have to go with Bergsvind simply for the defensive contribution she made and, of course, the goal to make it 2-1. Without her, we would have lost hideously, I think. Looking ahead to the next game, Brighton will be taking the positive aspects from this match onto Manchester City away next week. How do I think we're going to do? It's going to be a tough one again, but right now I wouldn't rule anything out. If we come out and play as we did yesterday, then it's not beyond the realms of impossibility that we get something up there. But that's a wrap for today's match analysis. It was a rollercoaster of emotions, and both teams displayed their quality on the pitch. The result on another day could have been completely different, but it was generally pretty positive. And I just hope we can carry this momentum into the upcoming tough run of fixtures.
Cool. Thanks for that, Dan. It's good to see that the Albion women are competing on a level with Manchester United, and arguably could have won that game if stoppage time didn't kill them at the end. But hey-ho, we move on to the next one against Man City and hope we can do better there and get the win. So Ajax next on Thursday. Dagan, can I get a score prediction for you, mate?
At Ajax, yeah. Scores have been high.
Who have just won two on the bounce, I believe.
They have. They have. Right. I'm gonna go 4-2 to the Albion.
High scoring. I like it. I like it. Alex?
I don't think it's going to be such a high scoring game, unfortunately, Dagan. I love the optimism, though. And I do think we're going to win. I don't think Ajax are going to be able to maintain their recent bounce back in form. And I'm going to say Albion, we're going to win 2-0 away from home at Ajax.
We'll take it. A lovely win in Amsterdam. I'm sure the travelling fans will love to hear that optimism. James, are you sharing the optimism of the rest of the guys?
My thought is, you know, new manager, we sort of embarrassed them a bit in the first leg, so they're going to be out to get us. So I'm going to say, at best, 1-0 to us.
Ooh, at best, wowzers. Harsh reality from James. I think we're going to go there and we're going to play a blinding game of football and we're going to win 3-0. So I'm going to join the optimism gang. Not to say James was pessimistic. 1-0 win is still good, but we'll take it. Just before we go, guys, I just need to do a few shout outs. So one, first of all, to One Klopp Shop. If you like football shirts, go over to their website and have a look at what they've got. If you see something you like, enter code ALBIONOBSESSED at the checkout and you can get yourself 10% off of your purchase. And that's every purchase. So you can go back there and reorder and use the same discount code. That's not a problem. And just so you guys know as well, that Albion Obsessed this month are doing Movember. So we are going to be moving, walking, running and attempting to grow. James knows that I can't grow one, but I'm going to attempt to grow one.
I can't either, so don't put your hopes in my basket.
But it's for a fantastic cause. It's for men's physical and mental health, something that isn't spoken about nearly enough. If you want to learn more about Movember, there is a link in the description. If you want to donate to them as well, you can do that via our link. And we're going to do some sort of charity streams throughout the month to raise the awareness and do all the good things for such a fantastic cause. So yeah, that rounds off another episode of the Albion Obsessed podcast. Thank you to Dagan, Alex and James for joining me today. Thank you for Dan for the women's roundup as well, which was great. And we will see you next time on another installment of the Albion Obsessed podcast. So yeah, don't forget to like, share and subscribe. I don't normally do this outro, Tom does, but Tom, I'm going to steal your phrase. Wherever you may be, whenever you may be, we'll see you next time. Take care.